So it's not as easy to manage as workers' compensation is, but we do believe 10% is something that is relatively safe. There have been, in the past, as you look at actuarial forecasts, they're not perfectly accurate, even under pretty stable circumstances. And so a 10% variation is possible, even if we'd stayed with our original number. We think it's reasonable to take a little more risk. It's not excessive. Now, we do carry, and I skipped over this, on property coverage, we carry excess liability insurance, which premiums are about $1.5 million a biennium. And what it covers is a loss up to $300 million. So we take the first $1 million on any single loss or $3 million in annual aggregate losses. And if we go over that number, then the excess insurance will kick in on property and pay up to $300 million. The way we reach the $300 million figure is by looking at Oregon Health Sciences University. That's our highest concentration of a single risk. If there was an earthquake, Health Sciences University would not fare well, and that's about the cost we'd be looking at. For tort liability, we have no general liability excess. There has not in the last decade or more been any liability coverage worth buying. They essentially offer you a plan that says if you pay us premiums, we'll charge you more than what your losses will be, and we won't cover what you really need. They exclude more and more things that we need covered, and it just hasn't been worth buying. We did buy it once or twice in the decade, and when I reviewed the last one that we purchased, why we concluded it wasn't worth having and canceled it. In fact, it was that bad.
How long ago was that?
That was 3 years ago. We do have a few liability policies for aircraft, for ocean craft, for foreign liability, some things like that that you need special coverage for. We probably have 100 little policies here and there for different special reasons like that. But general liability excess coverage is just not a rational cost. In fact, we looked recently at the idea of getting an excess liability policy just for auto liability, which we all have at our homes. And there are the quotes we got, and we had quite a number of quotes, ran about, we'll charge you $110,000 for what looked to us like would pay us $100,000. So it's just not, when you're as big as a state is, your losses can be very readily predicted, and nobody's going to give us a bargain because they know what it'll cost. The employee dishonesty bond is also in this pink area. We have about 18 to 36 claims in a biennium, and those cost around $250,000. They're so few and small that they're really hard to predict. We do carry an excess policy there, and that is cost us $160,000 for premium and covers us to $5 million on a single loss, over $50,000. Now, we buy that one because that's just an anticipated risk. We can't predict when anybody will hit us. But in this computer age, the risk of somebody taking you for $1 million is a lot greater than it was a couple of decades ago. And so it's prudent to carry that coverage even though we anticipate or hope never to use it. The alternative to self-insurance is something that sometimes we just take for granted, but every half dozen years we go ahead and ask our agent of record to tell us what they could find in the market if we were to stop self-insuring and start insuring. And the answer this time was about half what it was 6 years ago, but it still would be that they would charge $69 million for coverage that we currently cover with $33 million. Mm. So it's about 2 to 1. Mm. 6 years ago, it was about 4 or 5 to 1. There's a hard insurance market. And the reason, again, is we can tell what our losses are going to be, and that's the standard by which we use when we decide should we self-insure something. It is, can we predict it well? And we can predict most of these losses very well. Worker injuries, the green area, I'll come to in more detail with in just a little bit, but there we have about 50 to 55,000 FTE, depending on how you count people who work part-time. And we expect to have less than 2,500 time loss claims, which are 90% of the loss, in the next biennium, and a cost of about $88 million. The premium, however, for next biennium would be about $25 to $30 million. That's new information. It's even different than your reports. And I'll go into that in some detail in just a little bit. That's largely a carry forward that we're having. There are some uninsured risks out there that we don't insure them, so we don't know how big they are, but we do consult in those areas. That's, for example, public records and public meetings violations. We don't know what those costs are, but we do work with agencies to avoid the risk. Administrative Procedures Act issues we don't cover, but we do give advice on. contractual obligations, we don't cover those, but we also work with agencies to avoid lawsuits for contract violations, and asbestos is one which we don't insure, but we have a centralized responsibility for. Risk management really works for the legislature and the governor. We're really looking at the state agencies as almost through your eyes, saying what should we do to bring down costs and to still get the job done. But we get our work done through the agencies. There are only 28 of us and there are 50,000 of them. And so it's really the people out there in the agencies that do the work, and we merely try to consult with them, advise them, trick them, do whatever it takes to get them to do the job. The philosophy in Risk Management Division is not that risk should be avoided at all costs. It's neither what you'll hear from some people who used to own coal mines in the East, that losses, deaths, injuries are just the cost of doing business. We don't buy that one either. What we would really say would be that risk management is the process of making an operation safer without compromising the mission. And by the way, that's a quote from an interesting source. It's the Field Leader's Manual for the Saudi Arabian War right now. Desert Shield has a safety manual out, and that's a quote from it. It says, risk management is the process of making an operation safer without compromising the mission. Now, our view of that is, if in a military action where you believe you're going to take losses, you can say that you should still make the operation safer without compromising the mission. An agency is trying to do economic development or forestry or fish or whatever can certainly abide by that same standard. And that's the one that we promote. The pillars of risk management, if you will, the things that really make the risk management operate and that you would need, whether there was a risk management division or not, would be one, our database. We keep a database, and it's now got about 15 years of data on every loss the state has ever taken in the areas that we cover. We also have a database that covers exposures, how much we own of different things. You need to know that. If we didn't have them, then it would be like public records. We really don't know what it's costing us to violate things in public records area. You wouldn't know whether they're getting better or worse, as we did with work comp. If we didn't have the database, we'd have to pay higher premiums, even if we were self-insuring, because of this increased risk. We don't know what it's going to cost us, so we'll have to charge more to be safe. So it's a real critical issue, and one we can't even put a dollar on. It's worth probably millions to the state. Communication with top management and with all managers is probably the other pillar that makes risk management. Knowledge is the key to risk control. If managers at the top levels in government and out in the agencies know what the risks are and know what the remedies are, they'll manage them. If they don't know what it's costing them, if they don't know what the risks are, they'll look into other areas. So our communication lines, we think, are critical. Premium allocation, how we take these costs and give them to the agencies, is probably the other key issue, and one you would always have to deal with. Better decisions come from managers who know they're going to have to pay the price. They'll make a good decision. They can look at it and say, is it cheaper to do this or cheaper to do that, and they'll make those wisely. I could jump to a couple of the questions that were asked that really relate to this. One was, what does state government do about its bad drivers, for example? And essentially the answer there is an example of how we deal with risk management in almost all areas. The first is, we promote the philosophy to the agencies that it's management's responsibility. And management's responsibility should be to set clear expectations, to tell drivers what we expect of them, to train them adequately. We think every agency, every driver in state government should receive defensive driver training aimed at the kind of driving that they do, and properly equipping the workers. So for example, the motor pool is making sure that as it upgrades the fleet, it upgrades them with appropriate safety, including whatever they're called, airbags and the whole bit. We think that's the philosophy, and we think that the evidence shows that this is a good way to approach it. The reason we say that is that we just did the record for the agencies, the report in this last year for how driving incidents have taken place. We had the fewest accidents in the last 5 years in this last year. And I think that's really a spinoff from the safety effort that's been taking place statewide. State police citations were the fewest since 1983 also. Citizen complaints were doubled, and we think they were doubled because we're tracking them now in our computer database.
Ask you a question.
Certainly.
You said state police citation.
That's citations to employee driving a state vehicle.
We do that?
Yeah, and they report them to us. It would be, well, for example, if you were speeding, any of the typical traffic violations.
Why would we do that?
Why would we cite ourselves?
Why would we, as an internal policy in state, why would we cite one of our drivers rather than have an internal process by which we report a violation to the manager and deal with it internally? That, it
we
seems to me that if a police officer cites, and this is true, you know, if a state employee is involved in an accident driving one of our vehicles and the driver is cited in the accident, the exposure broadens. Now, you know, in terms
sure.
of what actually ultimately occurs in a civil action, I'm thinking of what occurs in our city, you know, being a former traffic investigator in the city of Portland, we did not routinely cite, you know, city drivers and city accidents if it was avoidable. We would write the necessary reports and cover it, but not issue a UTC or complaint. And if it was serious enough, it would go to the district attorney for review. But it was all a risk management type of a concept. I don't even know if there's a relevant figure you can attach to changing the policy.
There aren't that many of them.
Or state
first.
Police officers are
yep.
trained different than city police officers, too.
And also, I think I think another angle is too that state drivers are in many different jurisdictions, and one thing we don't know is how often they're cited by cities and counties. We know they are, but those are not always reported to us. Probably another issue is that when you pull over an e-plate, you don't know until, in fact, you may not know unless you call it in, and I don't know why they would, that it's even a state employee at that point. An e-plate could be, as we get with citizen complaints, we get a lot of them that are school districts or cities or whatever. We run the plate and then report back to the citizen, you need to talk to someone else and tell them who. But I think that might be part of the issue. I also look at it from a risk management point of view. It's kind of a logical consequence.
Except who pays the citation?
The employee.
The employee pays.
So if the employee's speeding, and we certainly don't
But there is an exception in statute for work-related traffic violations. That the in another interesting question, it does not go against the liability insurance premium of the driver in their private life because it's work-related.
And personally, I have a hard time understanding that. It seems to me that if you're a bad driver, it doesn't matter what the name is on the car. but yes, I think that we're. I can see some reasons why a city or maybe even a county might be able to do it differently than the state.
It seems to me like we have much greater control of city and municipal employees
yeah.
via a system by which you report a violation to the management structure
sure.
Because you can suspend somebody's internal right to drive a state vehicle. And that can be far more severe than merely writing a citation person paying that traffic ticket. You may, I don't know what checks and balances are in place. We had, for instance, in the city of Portland, a guy who had been driving a police car for 12 years with a suspended driver's license. You know, and it wasn't until they decided to start doing inspections and checking people's driver's license, they found out this guy had been suspended for 12 years driving a Portland police car. You know, he had 35 years on when they found this out, so he retired rather abruptly. But you know, the question is, you know, do we, in terms of traffic issues, do we check people's driver's license who work for the state to find out how many suspended drivers we might have?
When they check out a car, they do need to show a driver's license. But we went through an interesting process, which I mentioned in this. We pulled together a task force and said, we clearly need to have good operator standards, and we don't really have any that are in writing, essentially. And the task force included a number of agency people, Motor Vehicles, Traffic Safety Commission, our folks, others. And we did a national search, really, of major companies and organizations, governments, looking for their standards. We found a range from people that you would be sure, and I can't remember which one of the major utilities in Oregon, has no driver qualifications whatsoever. And yet they had a lower accident rate even than ours, and the state's is very low. We also found an organization here, a retail outlet, wholesale retail, that one ticket when you're driving their truck and you're through. So we've had the toughest and the non-existent ones. We then adopted, tentatively drafted, a very tough standard, I thought. It was defendable in terms of it's used elsewhere, the insurance companies accepted it, and so on. Then, because Motor Vehicles was involved in the task force, we asked them to run 100 of our accidents. So they took 100 of our drivers that had what we thought were at-fault accidents, and they ran them through, ran their motor vehicle history, and found that not a one of them would have violated that standard. We would have issued a permit, if we issued one, to every one of those drivers. At which point we then reappraised our need for this policy and decided it wasn't, there was no reason to sit down at the table with the unions and bargain over why they should take a new risk of ending employment, when in fact we couldn't even show a connection. What we are adopting then is a standard that simply says you've got to meet the state standards as a driver anyway. If you're driving a truck, you need the appropriately designated license to be a truck driver.
Are we doing something, again, I'm thinking, relating my own experience of one police officer in the city of Portland who had 18 traffic accidents within a short period of time, were all low-speed parking lot types of problems. And the Bureau decided the guy's too big of a risk, said you cannot drive a police vehicle or a city-owned vehicle. Put him on a desk for 2 years.
We do track those kinds of things and do ask agencies to do much the same as General Services just did. We popped up in the study as having a number of backing accidents, second year that that's happened. And so we're looking now at how can we find an appropriate procedure that will eliminate these backing accidents. They're not costing hardly anything, but they irritate citizens certainly, and there's just no reason to have them. We try to sit with the agencies and target them as we see the data and deliver the data to those that have a problem or a trend heading in the wrong direction and work with them to develop their own policies somewhat. Forestry is probably a good example. They have a different set of driver training for people who drive emergency vehicles, those who drive trucks, those who drive cars. And they'll require that you go through one of those schools before you move into that other class. Most of the agencies are really taking the training more than discipline approach. I'm still not comfortable that we have adequate knowledge about every one of our drivers. I would say beyond doubt we have somebody out there driving today who probably has a suspended license. I talked to a judge because some highway guys called me and said, you've got this crazy person out there driving and she's lying to the court and everything. So I called the judge down in Oak Ridge to talk to him. And sure enough, he had asked her if she had any citations. She said no. Turned out she had 8 moving violations in I think 6 different counties, not that one. And he felt that she probably misunderstood the question. And he also felt that he thought we ought to do something, but he didn't want her to lose her job. And when I talked to the institution, it was a higher ed employee, their approach was, if she lied to us on our application, we'll fire her. If she didn't, we will require that she drive her own automobile. And I, to this day, I'm not real sure whether I like or dislike that policy. If she drives her own car, then her liability policy is primary. So that makes some sense. On the other hand, if she drives her own car, she's less visible and therefore not likely to get citizen complaints and that kind of thing.
Of course, there's nothing guaranteeing that she's paying premiums on her own private insurance policy.
And that's the case as well. We do not police those folks that drive our cars to double check. We tell them you must have a valid driver's license and insurance, and we ask them to sign to that in most agencies when they take their car out. But no, there is nobody who's checking to see that that is the case. However, in our accidents, we've yet to have a case where somebody turned out not to be licensed or were in violation that way.
I suppose some costs might outweigh the benefit too, I suppose.
We did look at Motor Vehicles was willing to put these people on an automatic reporting system at $1 a head. That's $50,000 per year, and our total losses in that area clearly didn't warrant it. Driving incidents, though, we think is just like any other safety issue. There are a very few out there who are just plain callous and careless. But the rest need to know what to do and what's expected of them. And we're looking at that at General Services. We have an excellent customer service ethic. And we're now looking at making clear to our drivers, we want to have a diplomat on the road type ethic too. One that says yield the right of way. You can be late to the meeting. You don't have to work it out with the other driver by who can get there first. And we think that'll go further in the long run than a lot of other steps.
Dave, who else does risk management in the state of Oregon? Does the state police, do they have their own risk management section? Do their own assessments, and does forestry do theirs, or does
essentially no one has a risk management section. I think higher ed has a position they call a risk manager, but instead they divide it into several different areas. They will, when it comes to like go driver's education, for example, it'll be in very many different places and different agencies. One will have it in their personnel division. Another will put it in the substantive division that's dealing with some issue like forest fire fighting. Highway has a very highly centralized and bureaucratic, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, system of safety managers because they're spread out all over the state.
Well, who has general responsibility for
us?
Well, that's you. And that includes the state police. And,
yes.
Okay.
In fact, we do. I wrote to Reg Madsen just the other day on a workers' comp claim, for example. We use as many methods as we can to get the agencies to manage. I said we trick them. We set the premiums so that agencies are going to pay the losses themselves. Nobody subsidizes anybody. We try to make those premiums respond quickly to changes. So if they do a better job, their premiums will go down, or vice versa.
I'm glad to hear that, because I was afraid we had one of these fractionalized systems again, where you've got risk management with the state police and risk management with ODOT and risk management with general services. And
Oregon is not unique, but they're only about a third of the states that have as fully a centralized program as we do. I met once with the other state risk managers. They have an annual meeting, never in the Bahamas. I think next time it's in North Dakota.
The Cayman Islands thing.
Yeah. It wasn't Juneau, it's North Dakota next time, I think. But the jealousy that they have towards our program, and essentially it was the management in 1979, a legislative session that set up the program, and they did a comprehensive modern risk management program, and we get the benefit of it since. So
that's good. So
almost even the states that come close to us, most of them don't cover higher ed.
Was that
higher ed tends to kind of go its own way in most states, and here they're a very helpful cooperative part of the process.
I was just going to say one of their nudgings was an example of the workers' comp this last session where we required the agency heads of the 12 agencies with the worst record to come to e-board meetings every 6 months and report on what they were doing to improve the records.
In fact, that's probably the thing to move to here. And I'll come back to the question on theft because I've got so much neat stuff to say about work comp.
Bob's going to be thrilled to hear this.
Yeah. I thought I was away from that word.
We won't use innovation here. This is the story of time loss claims. They're 90% of the state's cost, of anybody's cost in workers' compensation. We used a running average because they jog up and down too much otherwise. But if you go back here at the far end, which is also in your paper, if you can't read that, I'm closer than I can. June 88 at the lower left-hand corner, moving to November of 90. So we're right up to just a month or two ago. And we were averaging over 130 time loss claims a month. We're now averaging about 64 per month. And in fact, in many months, we're down in the 50 range. It's been a lot of fun handling workers' compensation. It's been fun because we listen to agencies like Highway. They've been managing workers' compensation since 1947. They told us that. And they couldn't do it any better. They told us that. And they cut their claims in half. And virtually every agency out there, except the really bad ones, said, we just can't do any better than we're doing. And they were, the really bad ones then were simply mental health, mental health, mental health. And they have, like the rest of the state, done an amazingly improved job. In fact, I'll give you a few numbers on that. Last session, we were before the Joint Ways and Means Full Committee, and I made a presentation on work comp. And this is essentially what I told them. SAFE had threatened to double our state premiums the preceding year. The budget had been in trouble, the emergency board had had to straighten it out, help us with the money. November of 88, we did our first actuarial forecast ever done in Oregon outside of SAFE. And that show told us that we were going to have 4,112 time loss claims in this biennium, and it would cost us $142 million. A little worse than what SAFE was saying, but not much worse than what they were saying. The 1985 session had given risk management responsibility for work comp. The 1987 session gave us one FTE to manage work comp. And by the 1989 session, we were beginning to do something because it was just going crazy. The effort was underway, but, and I am happy to see Senator Yee here because I get to quote her. She said to me, I think at that time, you made a good presentation, come back with a report that lets us say you did a good job. And so that's, this is the good job report. Between the sessions, we kept doing what we were doing. It was a good challenge, an appropriate one. I won't go through all that we've done. My file cabinet has two full drawers on just the stuff that we've sent out to the agencies in the intervening 2 years. But I'll hit a few high points. One is the government leaders took their place and did something about it. The governor issued a executive order. Fred Miller took the top 12 agencies, we identified those that had the biggest losses, and brought them in every month to listen to me tell them how they were doing in front of each other. And that did have a telling effect. They started out in the beginning with a lot of we can't do it, and by the end we didn't need the meetings anymore because they were doing so well. But Fred kept them coming in. When Fred did performance appraisals on them, the performance appraisal dealt with the safety record of their agency. Representative Eldon Johnson apologized 15 times that he was stepping out of his role, but called mental health in with us and said in a private meeting, really, tell me what's going on here and what you're going to do about it. And that was a help. Senator Larry Hill did virtually the same thing with the Highway Division. And so there were other senators and representatives doing these things. The emergency board then said, let's bring all the top 12 in every 6 months and ask them how they're doing. Everybody this subcommittee put the budget note in. And as a result, all of the leaders of state government were saying, this can't go on. And that's a key, by the way, we think to workers' comp or risk in any environment. Risk Management Division centralized for the first time the premiums and policies. We went to SAFE and said, we don't want each agency buying coverage from you. We'll buy the coverage. We will redistribute the cost out to the agencies because, frankly, SAFE was not keeping up with the budget. They were under budgeting and moving around and changing premiums and not helping us out much. People weren't very happy with SAFE at that time either, so we needed to be the coordinator between them and the agencies. We targeted agencies using, which is my background in finance really, a marketing model saying, this is what we want to achieve. Who's our audience? Who is our target markets and how are we going to deal with them? We targeted the 12 biggest agencies. We sent them regular reports, something they'd never had before, on what their losses were and how they compared to everybody else. We produced risky notes every quarter. That goes to 6,500 managers. It's almost the only thing besides a paycheck that's communicated out to every manager that the state has. We do risk keys or guidelines on how to do early return to work programs. We sent that to them. We do risk ignition awards. In fact, Dan said, if we come up with one more play on the word risk, he was going to take our gold watch and break it.
Break it?
Yeah. But we give them risk ignition awards, and the legislative assembly got one, in fact, for its own staff. We gave training sessions. We do consulting, if you want to call them that. I can tell you what Stanley Major Hart from Damish said one time. Kate Wood and I were going out there. She's our risk coordinator for safety and health. We were going out there to call on Damish and just ask them something that all the administrators at General Services do. Ask them how we were doing. You know, is the print plant okay? Do you like your cars? Do the phones work? That kind of stuff. But we just said we were coming for a visit. And when we got there, Dr. Major Hart had all his key staff people there, and they looked tense. And we sat out and said why we're there, and he said, wait a minute, I want to tell you how relieved I am. He said, I was afraid.